Hello, I am Will Leach, the host of the People Still Read Books podcast. This is episode 5. I think it's 5. I come to you live 2 weeks from Election Day. Are you ready? Are you ready? We're going to do one more show before Election Day next week. After this one, we'll have Mark Leibovich, author of This Town and Big Game, political reporter, NFL reporter, all around awesome dude. See him on MSNBC, old friend of mine. He's going to talk about his books and preview the election for us, which will be fun. And then I'm going to take a week off after the election because, well, I say after the election, as if it will be over, as if it will ever be over. This week, however, I'm delighted to have on David Hill. You may know David Hill from some of the great work he did for Grantland back in the day. Still doing some great work. Same with The Ringer's got a podcast. But he wrote a wonderful book, just an awesome book, called The Vapors, A Southern Family, The New York Mob, and the Rise and Fall of Hot Springs, America's Forgotten Capital of Vice. I love this book a lot. It is about how Hot Springs, Arkansas, basically was a proto-Vegas back in the day, and all the mobsters went there, and it tells the story of how it became that way, and actually how David Hill's grandmother, who worked at the famous club called The Vapors, how she ties into the story, and it's really just a terrific book, and it tells a story that I didn't know. I've been to Hot Springs, Arkansas. I've never Jim Cook. Not to say remember Jim Cook. He's awesome. He's still doing great stuff. But Jim Cook was the old graphic designer for Deadspin and Gawker Media back in the day. An old friend of mine. He got married in Hot Springs, Arkansas. And so I mentioned this to David on the podcast. And it's a wonderful town. And all the signs everywhere are all about how Al Capone was here. Lucky Luciano was here. And I was wondering why they'd spent so much time in Hot Springs. David Hill's book does a pretty great job of explaining why. Update on my book stuff, by the way. I got bound manuscripts this week to send out to blurbers. Bound manuscripts are different than galleys, and it hasn't been copy edited yet. I met the copy editor this week. She's in Portugal. I didn't meet her, obviously, but I was emailing with her. She's in Portugal. She emailed me saying, I'm so sorry for all you people in America right now, which is a great place to be. But my book is out to blurbers, so some people are actually reading the darn thing now, so gulp. But regardless, we're going to do one more show before the election with Mark Leibovich. Remind you to please email me, peoplestillreadbooks@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter @stillreadbooks. Email me, I mean it. Email peoplestillreadbooks@gmail.com and allow us to find some more authors to come on. Right now, I've kind of drawn from my well of people I know. It's a pretty deep well. I've been in this industry for a while, but I'm looking for more varied names, people that I don't know, and people I can read books I don't know anything about, which I'm looking forward to being able to do as this podcast gets going. But for now, however, here is the great David Hill talking about The Vapors, A Southern Family, The New York Mob, and The Rise and Fall of Hot Springs, America's Forgotten Capital of Vice. I am delighted. Delighted is probably the word. I am delighted to have David Hill, author of The Vapors. One thing I've noticed during this podcast, by the way, boy, there are there's definitely not inflation. There's definitely a lot of inflation when it comes to the subject, to the subtext line of every book title. I've had this happen too with my books. They keep getting longer and longer and longer. I usually think that whenever they make the words longer in mine, what they're really saying is no one knows who you are, Will, so we're trying to explain this book as best we can for anyone who wants to read it. But this one is a great one. This is The Vapors, A Southern Family, The New York Mob, and The Rise and Fall of Hot Springs, America's Forgotten Capital of Vice. I'm delighted to talk to David Hill. David, first off, before we get going, I love the shit out of this book. Like, I have to tell you, this book is one of my favorite books I've read in a long time. I feel bad because I've had other guests on and I've told them how much I like their books, but I didn't go on about it like this. So I hope they're not mad. But in all honesty, thank you for writing this book and thank you for coming on.
Well, thanks so much. That's really cool to hear. And, you know, when I wrote the book, I thought I had a very limited audience and appeal. So it's been really cool to see people reacting to it the way they have.
So, so of course, a lot of the background to the book is the fact that it tells the story, of course, of Hot Springs, Arkansas, and the Vapors, the club. There, it builds a lot up into the creation of the Vapors, which is the great casino club of the time. But I'm curious because, you know, the side section story, of course, I wouldn't say the side section, I say quite connected in that, is the story of your grandmother, Hazel Hill. And I found myself, I was so into this book that I found myself watching every time that like James or Jimmy, your dad, first started showing up. I found like, hey, that's his dad. Hey, that's his dad. I was like the meme of Leonardo DiCaprio, like pointing at the screen every time that happened, which is a good sign that I think that I was into the narrative. But I'm curious, how much did you know about the Vapors growing up in this experience? Or is this something you kind of fell into later, having grown up in Hot Springs?
Well, I knew about the Vapors growing up because it actually was open until 1991, which is when it became a church. But the club was still open. It was sort of a nightclub. At one point, it became a honky tonk. At another time, it became a dinner theater. So it had been around my entire childhood. But I didn't know this. I didn't know the story of the Vapors for sure. I didn't know a lot of this. You know, this history growing up. You know, at least not what's told in the book. You know, I definitely knew some of the broad strokes. I knew that, like, one of the things I definitely remember was my dad telling me when I was young about Dane Harris's house being bombed, and we, you know, driving by his house and him telling me about the wall and about how it had been blown up at one point, and thinking that was very cool, you know. But no, I didn't know all of the stories about the Vapors as a kid, and I don't think a lot of people in Hot Springs knew much of this.
I don't think I quite realized until you've said this now that, like, you were, like, when did you leave Hot Springs?
1995.
So did you ever go into the Vapors when it was still, when it was, before it became the church? I know that you may have been, I don't know if you were too young, but, like, had you visited the place? Had you gone in, or, and did you just hear stories about it, or had you physically been in the place?
Yeah, I had never set foot in the place until a few years back when I was in Arkansas working on the book. I was able to take kind of a tour of it, but no, I had never been in it, but you know, plenty of people had. I mean, I was just a kid, you know, but,
right.
It was, but it was definitely, you know, it was, still a well, you know, well, it was still a fixture within the community, even into the 1980s, you know, like, it's still every once in a while managed to book Phyllis Diller or, you know, or like an Elvis impersonator or something like that.
right. The Branson runoff idea there. Now, I've been to Hot Springs. I don't know if you know Jim Cook, the old illustrator for Gawker and Dead Smith and that, still at mm-hmm. whatever weird media company now. He got married in Hot Springs. His wife was from Arkansas. So we all went to the bathhouse. We all joked it's the weekend that everybody's all the guys saw each other's balls. It was just the weekend that happened. And I probably shouldn't say that out loud. But to me, one of the things that was amazing to me and what was so vividly kind of illustrated in your book, that was more than 10 years ago before I had kids, which is why I don't remember much about it. But one of the things that's amazing to me about it was I remember being there and thinking, well, I had no idea that like Lucky Luciano spent time here and Al Capone spent time here. Now that I've read the book, to me, that gets filled in so much. I'm so curious, like what is it specifically about Arkansas and Hot Springs that allowed this place which again had the Vapors, which was this high class place, but also had some other, basically it was just all, the whole town was this den of vice and so on. What was it specifically about Arkansas's politics or Arkansas's people that made this the place that would become all of that?
Well, it was, I mean, quite literally, it was the water. I mean, if you look around the world, you know, there was a period of time when hot, like naturally occurring hot springs were thought to be medicinal. And so these spa towns existed all over the world. I mean, Baden-Baden and, you know, Monte Carlo or Saratoga Springs, you know, and Palm Springs, there's all these examples around the world of where these kind of hot springs, you know, that there were sort of spa communities that built up around the hot springs. And and Hot Springs, Arkansas was no different. You know, it's just that town in Arkansas where the hot springs in Hot Springs, Arkansas are the only ones of their kind anywhere in that part of the country, right? In anywhere in those sort of latitudes of North America. So that's why it sort of feels incongruent to think, like, why would there be all of this down in the deep South, you know, in the Bible Belt. But it had nothing to do with politics, really. It had to do with the fact that these that people were traveling to hot springs from really all over the world to take the baths, to take the waters at the orders of doctors, right? So then I'm talking about like the turn of the century, right? Into like all the way into like the 1930s, doctors would send patients to hot springs to sit in these baths to try to cure whatever they were sick with, and not just for like a weekend, but they just say, go stay in those baths until you're better, which meant sometimes people would be there for months and months, right? To become convalescent. So around these hot springs grew hotels and a hospitality industry. And so it also meant that con artists flocked to these places because there were lots of people traveling to these towns from other places. So lots of people who were from other places who were kind of like marks, you know, for to be plucked by con artists. And so casinos and gambling operations also kind of grew around, you know, and they became, there was sort of an outlaw culture that would sort of form around, and it didn't just happen in hot springs. So this is a long-winded way of me saying, this is the history of a lot of spa towns in the world.
Well, what's interesting too, is it seems to be the history one of the of kind of any town, right, that has any sort of boom. And to me, one of the most amazing things about this is to see the way that everybody wants a piece, and whether it's the local officials. And what's interesting to me is I think there is this idea, for those that know anything about kind of the culture of hot springs and the fact that they're like, that they're the gambler, like people think of like the gangsters and the mobsters all coming in there. But I think one of the things that was one of the many, many things interesting about your book is the idea that for a long time, hot springs was still had like a lot of corrupt leaders and had illegal gambling and all these things, but they actually tried to keep the mob out for as long as possible. Is that right?
Well, I think that's one of the tensions I think that exist in the book and in the telling of the story is that the sort of official story that Hot Springs has always told, even contemporaneously, like the sort of book on Hot Springs was that it was not being run by the mob, and that's why it was sort of quote unquote allowed to continue for as long as it did, right? Because what makes Hot Springs remarkable is it's the last standing, like wide open gambling operation in America into like the mid to late 60s. But I don't think that's true. I think one of the things my research showed and one of the things that I try to convey in the book is that the mob definitely was involved and was, you know, intertwined with the people who were leading the gambling operation in Hot Springs, but that it was important in order to continue to keep the kind of full-scale corruption from the governor's office all the way down to the dog catcher, it was important to tell this story that the mob was not involved. And that's because in the 1950s, America really started to turn on the mob, right? And there was going into the 60s and with Bobby Kennedy, there was a real push to like, you know, I feel like the mob had you know, they had sort of worn out their welcome with the level of corruption and violence that had gone on. And so Hot Springs saw this happening, and I think they rightfully realized that they needed to distance themselves from a lot of the like underworld figures that were a part of the business. But they were definitely there. I don't think there was any gambling going on in the United States of America in the middle of the last century that the mob didn't have a piece of.
Well, that's why I find one of the three major characters that you follow, your grandmother, Dane Harris, and Oni Madden. To me, the Oni Madden part is really one of the most remarkable parts of that, of course, because he was the owner of the Cotton Club. He was a gangster. He was talking about how he was known as the killer. But it's funny because he kind of goes to Hot Springs and becomes, I wouldn't say legit, but like he doesn't have to kill any people anymore. And he goes there almost just to kind of not so much. Yes, he definitely doesn't retire, but to almost take it easy. And it got me thinking of this idea that like it feels like that there was almost a strike zone in there where, and maybe this is the strike zone that Hot Springs succeeded with for so long, where you could have, if the balance could go just right, you know, you talk about the book about, you know, mobsters would almost think it's gambling as this victimless crime. And therefore it wasn't narcotics and it wasn't some of the other things they were involved in. And they could almost, it almost felt like the low stress part of this to be in Hot Springs. And to me, one of the most fascinating parts of the book is the idea that everyone seems to convince themselves that like this is not what's going on in New York and Vegas isn't going to work. This is the place. Like everyone's able to put on these kind of respectable airs, even the mobsters themselves, with the idea like this could actually work a little bit. And I feel like it's a fascinating thing to see him kind of do that too.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know that he had much of a choice. I think Oni had really, once he got married and realized, like, this is where I'm going to be now. I'm in Arkansas now. I think he was kind of all in on trying to help the Gamblers of Hot Springs figure out how to keep the business going. And, you know, that meant keeping the, you know, keeping the governor and all the political leaders in line. It was an expensive proposition, right? And one of the things that I thought was interesting that went on among Oni and the other gamblers and mobsters was that they really had an internal debate about should we push for legalization or not? Because on one hand, if we legalize this, we won't have to worry so much about who wins elections every couple of years. But on the other hand, if we legalize this, we won't be able to control it through corruption anymore, and we may lose control of it. And some people rightfully, you know, some people opposed legalization because they saw, like, oh, that'll mean that, like, as the county clerk, I won't be able to, like, get any graft anymore, right? And I thought that was kind of an interesting dilemma that they found themselves in, you know, once they realized that there might have been enough support to legalize it in Arkansas.
One of the large parts of the book is, of course, talking about Hazel, your grandmother, and kind of her story, really, from the age of, I guess, 13 or 14, when we're introduced to her, all the way through until there's a picture of you and her in the book. And what I find, I'm curious, having the family be a part of this story, the idea, like, when you'd heard of the Vapors, how much did you know from your grandmother, how much she was a part of it, how much she kind of glamorized it, how much it kind of meant for her at a point to her in her life? And then did you feel like, what made you decide not only to put her part as so much part of the story, but even in fact, you to move back as well? Like, do you have family still there? Like, that family experience of writing the book, bringing your own family there, and then writing about the generations that came before you. Was that always planning on something? Did you want to write the history and did you add that later, or what was the direction on that?
Well, I mean, I wrote a piece for the first piece I ever wrote for Grantland was about Hot Springs. It's called The Invaders. And I went to Hot Springs and wrote about a horse race, you know, ostensibly, but it was in true Grantland fashion. It also kind of like was a story about my family. It was a story about the history of Hot Springs. It was about a lot more than just this race that I went to see. In that piece, I talk about my grandmother and her later husband, who was a carny, it's sort of this wild story about him murdering somebody and then fixing a horse race. And, you know, it's its own kind of crazy story. But I also kind of delved into the history of the gambling operation in Hot Springs. And that piece, you know, I've said this in a lot of interviews, but like, that piece was a surprise to me because there was quite a big reaction to it. And most people were like, why have I never heard of this before? Why do I not know this history? You know, I think that's when I realized how much of this, you know, story that I grew up with, I took for granted. And not just the story of Hot Springs, but also the story of my own family, right? And realizing that, you know, that maybe my own, the story of my own family might be interesting and a little bit different and colorful in its own ways. And so, yeah, when I decided that I was going to write this book, I knew that I wanted to have this personal entry into the work. I mean, also, look, I'm not a historian, you know, I don't think that I could have just written a straight history of Hot Springs. It would not have been very good. I would, you know, I'm not, that's not like where my interest lies either, is in straight history. So I felt like I needed to have some personal entry into this to make this book work, you know, in my own voice and to be something that I myself would want to read. But, you know, my family also aren't important to the history of Hot Springs either. So I had to kind of figure out how to weave all these different characters in these two different stories together. But, you know, I'm glad that I did it the way I did. I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, the experience of doing family research and learning more about my family, you know, that was really meaningful to me. And at the end of the day, no matter what happened with the book, I just knew at a certain point on this process that I was really grateful that I got an opportunity to do it.
And so you did move back to to Hot Springs to work on it, correct?
Yeah, for a year.
A year, okay.
That's all my wife would give me.
Yeah, that's a lot, to be honest. I mean, I've had a great time in Hot Springs, but you guys live in Brooklyn. Like, was the whole family there? What was that process like? Was it how did you juggle everything? How did she juggle everything? How did your kids juggle everything?
Well, we were about to have our third child, and so we figured you know, there was sort of a moment where we were talking about like, oh, we're probably going to have to find a new apartment now. And we were talking about, oh, like how much, you know, how much maternity leave do you think I'll get from work? And I was in the middle of trying to write this book, like, you know, I was flying down there a lot, you know, like every couple of months or whatever. And I was paying people to help me with research. And so I said, you know, why don't you just take like an extended leave from your job, you know, instead of like maternity leave, and let's just go to Arkansas and let's finish this book and we'll figure out where we're going to live, you know, with where five of us can live whenever we get back. And so, you know, she took a year from work and we packed up our apartment and we headed to Arkansas for a year. And we really didn't know what was going to be next at that point. You know, we sort of planned out our next moves from Arkansas, and we didn't know whether, you know, she'd taken a year off from work, but honestly, there were moments during that year where I thought, you know, maybe we could stay here longer if we needed to. Hell, maybe we could just move down here. I mean, it was so inexpensive to live there, and people were so hospitable, and I was so charmed by Hot Springs while we were there, and, you know, really kind of like started to like fantasize about, well, why don't we just stay in Arkansas? But we were also there during the election, so, you know, that wore off real quick. That wore off at that point. And I was like, let's get back to New York.
So I'm curious now because, you know, of course, you worked in this book for how many years? I don't know when that Grantland story ran, but how many years start to finish from when you first like, okay, I'm doing this project, and whether you sold it or whatever project until I guess July of this year when it came out.
Yeah, I sold the proposal in 2015. So, you know, it was 5 years from selling the proposal to the book coming out. I don't think that we, you know, I don't think I didn't think it would take that long. And honestly, not all of that time was research and writing. You know, I think I really did not have a good sense of how much would go into, how much work there still was to be done after I, you know, submitted my first draft of the manuscript.
Yes.
So
yes.
I really underestimated that. But yeah, I think that, it was 5 years from selling the proposal on, and you know, it maybe took me, I don't know, a few months to write the proposal. So I wouldn't say that it was that many years. I did not have the idea for this book after I wrote the Grantland piece. I think that was sort of the inkling, the seed, you know, that planted the seed of the idea, but it really didn't. And honestly, back when I wrote that first piece for Grantland, nobody was asking me to write a book, nor was I even thinking about writing one, you know, so it just was sort of there in the back of my mind. And so when it finally did come time that people were asking me to write a book, you know, I thought, well, maybe I could write a book about Hot Springs.
Yeah. You know, a lot of this podcast too is about kind of about that, the process and the production of all these things. And so you go through all of this process and all of this happens and you've put it together and you've written this, what, as I hope I've made very clear, what I think to be an excellent book. And it comes out in July of 2020 in the middle of all of this. Obviously there are adjustments that have had to be made. But to me, you know, like my book, the reason I started this podcast is because I have my novel coming out next year and it's coming out in May. And so at first I thought, oh, May will be plenty of time. That will be, we'll be over this long by then. Now it becomes increasingly unlikely for that to be the case. I'm curious, did you have a lot of plans put together for July of this year that have had to be scrapped? Or was it still late enough for the process where you're like, okay, cancel the big party in Hot Springs, what we're going to do? Had you even gotten that far yet?
No, it's true. We definitely, I mean, there was a sort of a tour and festivals and, you know, all those things. They were all canceled. But I don't know how to feel about it, honestly, because like what I have gotten to do this summer is like a lot of events for bookstores virtually, right? And I've talked to some of those bookstores where they were like, wow, you know, we had like 200 people or whatever log on and watch this. And, you know, if we had done this here in the store, there'd have been 25 people here, right? So, you know, I think that like I've had an opportunity to, you know, talk about the book and read the book and I've gotten to do more things for more people because it's all on the computer, even though I really haven't left my basement all summer. But I didn't get that opportunity of getting to be in rooms full of people, you know, and signing books for them. I mean, that's been a whole mess. Like, trying to figure out how to sign books has been such a whole ordeal, right? Like, people send me these boxes of books here at my house. I sign them. I send them back. Or I'm sending people book plates. Yeah. You know, so I haven't had that experience that I think authors all look forward to, the, like, kind of victory lap when the book comes out, where you have a party, you have, like, a tour, or you get to, you know, do all these events. But, you know, because we're all, but, you know, who knows? I mean, some people think that maybe people are reading more because of quarantine and being stuck at home. So maybe it's been good for my book. There's no real way for me to know. I know that I just went through that range of emotions from being really devastated and kind of, like, you know, disappointed that the book was going to come out in the midst of all this, to feeling like, who knows, maybe it was better. You know, I really have no, there's no way to know.
Do you, I ask this of everyone, and it's usually the last question, but I have a couple more after this one, but it seems a good time in the conversation. This was your first book. When did you get your copies? Like, when did you hold it in your hand for the first time, and what did it feel like?
Well, there are a couple of moments like that, right? I mean, the moment that really sticks out for me, the most was seeing the cover, right? So I got this, I'm sitting in a doctor's waiting room with my kids, and I get this email on my phone, and it's like, you know, the subject is the cover. And that's one thing where, like, I had been imagining this cover for 5 years, right? Like, what will it look like, you know? And so it was really scary. I did not want to open it because I was so worried that, like, because I have no control over this. I have no say in the cover, but the cover is so important, right? And I got really nervous. I didn't want to open it up and look at it because I was too scared that, you know, I wouldn't like it or something. And then I opened it, and it was, I mean, I don't know. I think the cover
is an incredible cover.
Yeah, it's such a great cover. It's so, I could not have, it couldn't have been any better. Like, it was so, like, exceeded any of my wildest expectations. And so I remember looking at it and just beaming about it, you know, and feeling like, wow, that is really, really a cool cover. And even my editor was like, this cover is badass. Like, this is going to sell, the cover will sell books all on its own, which maybe it has, maybe it hasn't. I mean, bookstores were closed, so right. I don't know that we know. But I also remember, you know, seeing on the internet that people were, and getting texts from people and seeing tweets where people had the book before I did. And I think this is a COVID related thing where, where they had not shipped me any copies of the book,
oh, wow,
but they were shipping out the promotional copies to people. And so I'm looking on, you know, one day I think I opened up, you know, Instagram or something, and there's like a picture of someone holding my book, and they're like, wow. And I hadn't yet to even see it. And that really sucked. I hated that.
Yeah.
I can understand that. And then FSG sent me a bunch of book plates to sign, these little stickers, right? Yeah. And so long before I even had a book in my hand, I'm sitting here signing stickers and mailing them back to them for them to stick on other people's books. So by the time the book's... It is. By the time the books finally arrived here at my house, I mean, so they had been out in the world for so long at that point that, you know, so it kind of was it took a little bit of the, you know, the excitement out of that moment. But
oh, for that was of all the people I've asked that question to, that is definitely the saddest answer. There's no question about that whatsoever. Okay, two non book things to close out. First off, I want to ask about Grantland. Actually, this started from a story from Grantland. It's been, I was covering the Mets Royals World Series and sitting next to Ben Lindbergh when all the Grantland stuff went down. Now that it's all passed, and it's weird to think, because particularly not just from Grantland, but just how much the world has changed in the last 5 years. I'm curious, what are your overarching takeaways? Do you get nostalgic for the old days? Do you feel like it was just this thing that was too beautiful to live in a lot of ways? What's kind of your overarching takeaways of the old Grantland days?
I mean, I guess in a weird way, like, what I miss about those days is just that people were reading, you know, that kind of long form. I really feel like it's getting harder and harder for long form to, you know, find an audience and catch on the way that it was able to back then in the early 2010s. And that's just based on nothing, right? I don't have any like data to back that up, but just anecdotally, I feel like it's harder for those of us that write long form to see to publish a piece and really see it, you know, whatever, see people reading it and reacting to it in real time and getting excited about it or talking about it or whatever. It's, I think we're inundated with, you know, there's so much of it out there. And I think people are also very focused on, you know, the crises that are facing our society right now. And that makes it tougher too, for some of that kind of journal, those kinds of pieces to, but you know, having said all that, I mean, I'm still trying to write that stuff. A lot of people are, and I'm still, you know, I think that, and I still read good stuff, you know, all the time, but it just doesn't feel the same way that it did back then. So it's not a very articulate answer to your question, but, you know, that's the thing I take away. The thing I miss the most is just that it felt like more people were reading back then than are now.
Yeah. I think it, like everything, just everything felt a little bit more exciting then, if just because, maybe that's because nothing feels exciting now, but that's certainly possible. Okay. The last thing.
It's also harder. I think today it's like, I'm doing a podcast right for The Ringer and it's about gambling, right? And gamblers. And like, I felt this way about my book coming out this summer too. I mean, my book was released on July 7th, which was like blackout day. You know what I mean? Which was like the worst day for a book to be released. I feel like it's difficult right now in this moment, this sort of political and cultural moment we're in, to get real deep and get real, you know, serious about things that maybe are considered, that aren't considered as, you know, serious or as important as some of, like I said before, the crises that we're in. So talking about sports or, you know, talking about sports or leisure or these kinds of questions and like getting real deep on them almost feels like obnoxious, right? When there's so many more important things for us to like get real deep on than like a basketball game or, you know, or a horse race or something.
Yeah, I've noticed this even with my weekly New York Magazine column, which is really, you know, the idea of that column has always been to be, you know, sports in the context of the larger world. But in the past, that always worked out well. This year, it's felt like, okay, larger world, and I promise just to justify the let me keep doing this, there will be some sports. And I almost feel like you have to do it that way, which is kind of a weird way to do it. But I guess there's no choice. Okay, last thing. I live in an SEC town. You're an Arkansas guy. How do you? I know that was a rough. I want to give you this opportunity to just scream about the call at the end of the Auburn game if you feel so inclined. I just want
which
to have
call? Which call? They're all the non-call. Every week. It's another call. I know. But there's another bad call every week with this team, man. With the Razorbacks. I mean, I'm usually not that guy. I'm not a guy that blames games on the refs. But in this case, I absolutely blame it on the refs. I mean, they were cowards. They didn't want to call the game. You know, they want to decide the game on their call. But yeah, definitely blew the call there. But honestly, they shouldn't be playing anyway. So maybe it's all just evening itself out.
It has definitely been a strange thing, again, being in a college football town. The idea that like even like I thought baseball was pushing it, but like baseball. You know, Paul Goldschmidt would rub shoulders in a grocery store with someone who may have been exposed to someone who had COVID, and they would shut down the team for a week and a half. And in college football, it's like, we have enough bodies, right? As long as we have enough bodies, we can keep playing. So it's like this is the week I'm recording this, the weekend before the big Georgia-Alabama game. And even down here, like Georgia-Alabama, it's like, I mean, it's the history of Georgia football over the last 10 years. It's all everybody cares about is beating Alabama. And people, I mean, obviously Nick Saban has tested positive at this point, but it still feels like it's not the same. And to me, I think that's, I find myself when you think about like, whether it's worth it, whether they should be playing, we all kind of have to make that decision with ourselves. Is like, are we willing to watch this? Are we how complicit are we with this? And my general thought is they should not be doing this, particularly in college. They should not be doing this. But you know, things are really hard for everyone right now. If you're going to tell me that even if I think they shouldn't do it, if for 3 hours there's going to be something where I'm not thinking about all of this, all that stuff that I find it weird, because all that stuff I used to try to avoid, to be like, listen, you cannot divorce sports from its context. You cannot divorce sports from politics. During the pandemic, I'm intellectually aware of that, but emotionally, I'm totally lying myself to forget it.
Yeah. I know it's amazing to me how much I really appreciate that sports is on right now. It has so helped my, you know, my own, you know, so selfishly it's helped my own like psychological state as someone who is like not rarely leaves the house to have sports to watch and to pretend like the world is normal outside of this bunker that I'm in. And so even though I, like you, I feel very, you know, kind of conflicted about it, I do appreciate that it's there. It has helped me, you know, it has helped me personally, you know, mentally to have sports to watch and to commiserate with friends over and to like experience, you know, kind of experience some semblance of normal life. But it is very weird. And like I have a cousin, you know, in Arkansas, high school football is, you know, huge. And, you know, I have cousins that play football and for pretty big, you know, 6A teams down there and are trying to get to college on scholarships. And, you know, so they're playing, right? And like, it sucks that they're playing, but also like, this is, you know, for seniors, this is like their year to like, try to like land a scholarship. This is like their future on the line, right? In terms of going to college. And so I kind of get it, even though I hate it. The whole, you know, so it's all, you know, it's all just so filled with, you know, conflicting emotions.
Yeah. The public high schools are playing football down here, but my first grader is not in school down here. It's a hard thing to wrap your mind around. Is it really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, up here in New York where I live, you know, the high school football anyway is on hold until the spring, which means it's probably not going to happen at all. Right. But New York is not Arkansas when it comes to football. That's for sure.
That's definitely not Georgia. I have learned that in my 7 years since leaving New York. David, I'm not going to embarrass myself anymore with this, but like, seriously, like this, like if you were to genetically engineer the type of book that I love, this is that type of book. And it's done. And you've done such a great job with it. And I really cannot encourage everyone to read it enough. The book is The Vapors, A Southern Family, The New York Mob, and The Rise and Fall of Hot Springs, America's Forgotten Capital Advice. Please get to work on your next book now, because I will want to know what horrible circumstances we will be in when it's released. David, thank you so much for your time.
You.
Continued good luck with the book, and it was a delight to get to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, and same to you. I can't wait to read it.